Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm dynamite.
You know what I want to talk about?
What do you want to talk about? Dynamite?
No, I don't want to talk about dynamite. You know what I want to talk about today is I want to talk about this new phenomenon that's happening in Manhattan. More and more places we're seeing are sort of trying to fly under the radar and stay under the radar.
Yeah, there's an article in the Times about this just recently as well. And, it is an interesting phenomenon because...
Well, let's explain what we're talking about.
Okay, absolutely, please.
So what we're talking about is restaurants who open... with no press, they don't want any press, or mostly this is happening a lot with cocktail bars. No press, sometimes no sign.
Sometimes no phone number.
Sometimes the unpublished phone number. And they're designed to be exclusive little places. And everything from Graydon Carter's restaurant, the Waverly Inn, which is, you know, it's doing the dry runs, or it's doing it's not open yet. It's hasn't had its official opening, so you can't get in, except that it's open every night. so it's great. It's who do you know to get in? That's the one thing. Two, a place like that's been around for a long time, a favorite of ours, a place called Milk and Honey, which is an unmarked door in Chinatown that you got to know where it is and you got to know the number to make a reservation.
Well, there are two things here going on, and I want to talk about both of the things that are going on.
Yeah, let's explain to people why a restaurant might choose to do that.
And the first one is you want to be a place that, you know, just local people come to, that just, you know, you don't want to get overcrowded with people who you don't know. You just want to keep kind of a neighborhoody kind of place. And I think in New York City that is becoming more and more challenging.
Well, and I think that also a lot of these places don't want, I mean, the Graydon Carter doesn't want a neighborhood kind of place. And in a lot of these cocktail, it's not that they want the neighborhood place, but they want people who want to go to a civilized bar and have a quiet cocktail. And the thing about it is, if you have 30 seats in Manhattan to seat people for cocktails, and you get written about as the coolest place for cocktails, you're going to be...
inundated with new people.
Inundated, and there's going to be a line out the door, and you know it's going to be like Yogi Berra said, you know, that place got so busy nobody goes there anymore.
Right.
And so it leads more to a flash in the pan, where I think a lot of these places, the idea, because you know, Sasha Petrosky is the guy who owns a couple of places in Manhattan, Little Branch, he owns Milk and Honey. Milk and Honey has a branch in London as well. But if you talk to him, he's not trying to be exclusive. He's not trying to say, oh, you're cool enough to get in or you're not. He wants to run a civilized bar, and he wants to be here for a long time. And so he needs his regulars to be able to get in and to maintain, and not just regulars, but people who, you know, really are seeking out that sort of environment, not just following what the, you know, Time Out New York says is the coolest new cocktail
and
bar.
Remember, sometimes what happens in our business, and certainly in the hot, trendy cocktail business, what will happen is your regulars will kind of become ensconced pretty quickly. Then the people who follow the trends will immediately follow those people. Well, if they end up pushing your regulars out, well, then your regulars need to find a new place to go.
Yeah.
And the trendy people
are going the next time something else is hot.
The next trendy thing that happens, they're moving to that. Well, now what have you done? You've pushed out your regulars. The trendy people have come in, and now the trendy people are gone. And what do you have?
Right, you're empty.
You're a passing fancy. That's all you are.
I think the market forces in large cities, you know, I think that restaurants, especially restaurants in small cities like we have in New Brunswick, you're less apt to be subject to these.
Of course.
But in New York City, where the winds of, you know, Japanese tourists can slam your restaurant, not that I have anything against Japanese tourists, but what I'm saying is the reach of the press is so far and so great if you have a little 50, 60 seat place, you're trying to run a civilized little place, you can be overwhelmed in no time. And a lot of these people don't want a line. They don't want a velvet rope. You know, Studio 54 was different. They wanted the line out the door and for you to feel lucky enough to get in. That's not the point of a lot of these places, I think. It's just that they want to be able to do what they do and keep doing it.
And some of you are calling me from Japan and saying, hey, I want to be able to get into Milk and Honey. So it's a, this is a real phenomenon. This is actually happening. You know, there is a second side to this, too, and I think we need to discuss the second part of this. And the second part of this is there are people who are trying to stay under the radar while publicizing that they're under the radar.
Well, yeah.
In order to use that kind of...
To add to the cachet.
To try and be the under-the-radar place that's not really under the radar.
Well, and now, let's take Waverly Inn as an example. Graydon Carter, obviously of Vanity Fair magazine, a very important publisher, has taken the Waverly Inn, which is a very historic place, a very historic bar that was going to close. He took it, renovated it, and now it's a great restaurant. It was always, you know, a great old bar. It was kind of a dive bar until he took it over. But now here you have a very public figure who's dining in his own restaurant quite often with major celebrities. I'm like, come on.
It is definitely a place to be seen.
Right. So you're not really doing what we were talking about before. But there are a couple of places one is called Death & Company on 6th Street in Manhattan. And I hear great things about that. They're getting a lot of great – I know a couple of bartenders who've gone to work there. Actually, I heard from one by email last night who gave me the number, so nice. I'll let you know, but I can't give it out on the air. I think they're trying to do that sort of a thing. I'll go back to one of our favorite cocktail bars overall, which has achieved it. There's no secret number. It is a door. It does have a name on the door. You can see the name on the door, but it's the Pegu Club, P-E-G-U, the Pegu Club, owned by Audrey Saunders. Very civilized, but even there, sometimes on a Saturday night, I avoid going out on Saturday night, but I'll avoid the Pegu Club at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock on a Saturday night sometimes, because it's not my regular haunt. But I think they're big enough to handle the winds of popularity.
You know, and I'll just do a little sidebar just for one second. One of the great things about being in this business is not having to make your night off be Saturday night, the same night that everybody else has off. I think that most of the people listening to the show, I think you're at a huge disadvantage because you kind of have to go, just like you have to
get
sit,
up on Wednesday morning.
but just like you have to sit in lots of traffic to get through the Holland Tunnel at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, Mark and I go out to dinner at 9 o'clock on Tuesday night. We zip right in,
problem. We don't sit in any of that, what I'll call it is restaurant traffic. And it's a very, very different experience to go out to Pegu Club or to go to one of these hot, trendy places on Tuesday night at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning than it is to go out to them on Saturday night at 11 o'clock at night.
Well, I also think that one of the things, and I think Pegu does a great job of managing the expectations and managing the crowd, and there not being too much of a crowd most of the time. It's on the second floor. It's a discreet little door, and the bartender is very much in control.
If you're a passerby, you're not happening into the Pegu Club.
Exactly.
You're going to the Pegu Club because that's where you're going.
Right. You think it might be a private club or something, even from the door you don't even see. But I think that what these places are trying to do is to figure out a way to maintain a consistent sort of low key. And believe me, as I get older, I look more and more for a low key place to
and
go
consistent.
And have a cocktail. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I think that there are a lot of people who sort of get put off by it, but I think there are legitimate reasons for this kind of stuff. If you want to reference the article, it's in the New York Times on January the 14th.
I also think there are a couple of illegitimate reasons for things like this.
But if you want to find out some of these places, you can go to the New York Times. The article is called Come to Our Club or Not, whatever, January 14th. Check it out in the Times. And there's the names of some cool places that you can find out. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. Our guest today is John Rowley. Now, John's a pretty important food guy. After spending years as a commercial fisherman, he developed a fresh fishery for the king and sockeye salmon of the Copper River. He's also an expert on oysters, and he started the Pacific Coast Oyster Wine Competition. And he's also been called the Dean of Dirt for his advocacy and knowledge of composting.
John, welcome to the show.
Francis and Mark, I'm very very glad to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You're a busy guy as far as food, from the ocean to the dirt. You've really made a big difference on a lot of different things.
Yeah, well, I have as kind of a hobby of mine. I have an interest in trying to make things taste better, you know. So that takes me to out on the boats to improve the handling of the fish, and when you're talking about peaches or tomatoes, it takes you to the soil. So I go off on these 4 or 5 year tangents, trying to learn how to make what makes plants successful, and it comes down to organic matter in the soil, compost.
Sounds like your hobby's taking you about 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
At least.
Let's talk about, because I found this to be a fascinating story. Let's first start talking about salmon from Copper River. Now, when you first got involved in this, the Copper River salmon, by the way, today out there, we get some every year. All the best restaurants look for it. There's a limited amount. It's managed, and it's widely considered to be the best salmon you can get when it's fresh, and you can only get it fresh for a very short period of time. But when you started looking at this, John, all of that salmon was mostly canned, and whatever was fresh wasn't very good. Is that true?
Well, there wasn't any fresh salmon coming to the market back then. That was quite a few years ago, about 1983 to be specific, and it was all going into cans except for a small quantity that was being frozen, and that was all going to Japan.
So,
well, just for one second, let's talk about the marketplace, and before you were bringing fresh salmon to the marketplace or caused it to happen, or at least aided in that. What I mean, how long would a salmon gets fished out of the water? Okay, why don't you go through how long it might be before that salmon appeared in your supermarket refrigerator case, and the process therein?
Well, it depends, and there was fresh salmon coming from Alaska. There's they're caught by different methods. There's I used to have a salmon troller, which is a type of hook and line fishing, and that fish was being shipped out. A certain amount of that was coming out fresh, but it just depends on the pipeline, but it could be a week, as long as a week before it's showing up in your supermarket case. But under the best of conditions, about 3 days, and then some of these promotions that I've done where we've got a lot of razzle-dazzle behind them, we put it on the plane and take it, get it there the next day.
Well, that's what's happening now. Tell us what was happening before.
In 1979, how was the fish being handled at the Copper River?
Well, it was, it's caught in, it's a gillnet fishery up there, and so the fish was being brought aboard the boats, and they didn't have any refrigeration, and then they were put on tenders, which are these large scows, which the boats unloaded on, and then the scows would go down to the canneries when they filled up. So there wasn't any, the fish weren't cleaned and they weren't refrigerated, and when they go into cans, the canning hides a lot of
misdeeds. That doesn't sound very appealing. The not cleaned and not refrigerated week-old fish, or several-week-old fish.
Well, they're just a day or two old at that point when they get to the cannery to be canned.
Any fisherman, anybody who's ever been out fishing, one of the first things you want to do once you catch your fish, and it's about to die, is you want to clean it.
Yeah, you want to clean it, and then and it turns out that getting it into ice before it goes into rigor mortis is one of the key things to quality and flavor, mouthfeel. And how a fish goes through rigor mortis is an important thing.
Well, now let's talk for a moment about that. That sounds kind of morbid, but it's actually pretty important. So the fish comes out of the water, and you want to gut it and bleed it right away. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, maybe I could just walk you through a perfect fish scenario.
Great. You know what? Hold on 1 second. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and you can walk us through a perfect fish scenario. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:24.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with John Rowley about fishing, specifically about Copper River salmon, which he helped to establish the fresh fishery of Copper River salmon, which is now the most sought-after salmon in the world. You were going to tell us the ideal fish catch, like how it gets from water to plate.
Yeah, if we're going to produce a perfect quality fish, we're out on the boat, and the first thing we want to do is make sure the fish comes aboard alive. When a fish dies in the gear, it just doesn't taste right, and I don't have the background to explain.
Doesn't matter why.
It doesn't taste right. That's all we really need to know.
So you want the fisherman gets the fish out of the gear alive, and then ideally he stuns it with a little club just right between the eyes, and then the fish doesn't flop, so it doesn't bruise itself. And some of these king salmon are quite large, between 25 and 50 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's still alive, and then you stick a knife, you open an artery up, and it bleeds itself, and then it dies kind of a relaxed death. And then ideally you eviscerate the fish as soon as possible before it goes into rigor mortis, and that's so that you can ice it before it goes into rigor mortis. And how a fish goes through rigor mortis depends, the ultimate flavor of that fish and the mouthfeel of that fish, it depends on how it goes through rigor mortis. And the best thing that can happen is you get that fish into ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens, it goes into rigor mortis very slowly, and it stays in a long time.
So you kind of slow the whole process down by icing it.
Yeah, and it comes, and then it comes out slowly. Now, what happens, what makes fish taste good is this, it's this chemical called inosine monophosphate. I think I have that right. And it starts being manufactured in the fish when the fish goes into rigor mortis. So what makes fish taste good actually happens after the fish dies.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So, and the longer it's in rigor mortis, the more of this substance the fish has.
So your idea is to slow the process down so that it stays in rigor mortis for longer.
Right. And then the best time to eat a fish, if you have the, if you're lucky enough to be able to, be there when all this is happening, is right when it comes out of rigor mortis, because that substance starts going away as soon as the fish comes out of rigor mortis.
Well, let me ask you two questions. How long does it take for a fish normally to go into rigor mortis?
If you're on that boat and you let the fish go through rigor mortis in ambient temperature, it can be in and out of rigor mortis in, 3 or 4 hours. Maybe.
And when does it start? How soon does it start?
It starts, it depends on the water temperature and the air temperature and things like that. But usually, from 3 to 5 hours after it comes out of the
Now, when a fish is iced properly, how long will it stay in rigor mortis, and when does it start to come out of rigor mortis?
If you don't need to handle the fish, to ship it or things like that, and once you ice the fish down, it can be in rigor mortis for 4 or 5 days.
Absolutely fascinating.
And that's it's counterintuitive, but that's when the fish would be, extraordinary, is if you could keep it in rigor mortis without moving, without handling it, and then as soon as it starts to relax, eat it right at that point.
When we come back from the news, we're going to talk with John Rowley about another topic of which he is an expert. We're going to talk about oysters and wine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everyone. everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is John Rowley. John is a very important fish and food guy. We're currently talking with him about, we were talking in the last segment about the salmon fishery that he basically established, the fresh fishery for Copper River salmon, which is the most sought after salmon in the world. We get some at our restaurants every year, and we throw a little party when we do. But also, you started you're also very into oysters, correct?
Yes, oysters, and I do a lot of work with oysters, wines.
Well, you started the Pacific Coast Oyster Wine Festival. What's that all about?
Well, it's the Pacific Coast Oyster Wine Competition, and what happened? I do consulting in the restaurant business, and I was doing a lot of work with getting restaurants started with oysters some years ago, and I was finding myself recommending French wines, you know, Chablis and Muscadet, you know, to go with oysters in these oyster bars we were setting up. And then they're good, but I started looking up and down the West Coast at all the wine industry here, and it's pretty substantial. And I said, geez, we have to have some wines that go with oysters.
But I'll bet you were right.
And so, but the only way to find out what they are, because we don't have that, you know, long tradition of of certain wines being identified with oysters, is that we had to eat a lot of oysters and drink a lot of wine. So,
oh, you poor fella.
So we set up this competition to find out which wines made on the West Coast go best with oysters, and it's kind of a month long ordeal.
Now, who judges this stuff?
Well, I have a group of preliminary judges here in Seattle. There's about, we have somewhere around 160 wines entered every year, and we have five judges that go through every wine with an oyster and narrow it down to 30 and then to 20. And then we have panels in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle of about 12 judges each, and they're writers and restaurant people and, people like that. It's partly a marketing deal, but we get a good sampling, and it's and we come up with 10 equal winners. There aren't many wines that go with oysters, you know.
Well, especially New World wines. There aren't a lot of New World wines that go well with oysters.
Yeah, even there's probably more wines per bottle of wine in Europe that go with oysters than there are.
There's a certain mineral characteristic that I like with my oysters.
What's that?
There's a certain mineral characteristic in my wines that I like to go with my oysters.
Yeah, definitely that. And then I like something that's dry, crisp, and then it has a clean finish to it. When you eat oysters, you take them, one after another. You know, have an oyster and then slurp it down and then have a sip of wine and then go to the next one. So I don't like to have any lingering aftertaste when I go to the
next. You want something really quaffable.
I generally eat my oysters one after another. It's kind of
one after another and after another and after another.
Exactly. A dozen or two at a time.
There's a sauce called the classic, one of the classic accompaniments with oysters on the half shell is a mignonette sauce, right? Which is red wine vinegar, red wine shallots, little black pepper. And we used to throw a party every year. Mark and I, we belonged to this lunch club, and every year we'd have a barbecue. We'd go out to lunch 11 months of the year, and then in August we'd have a barbecue. And somebody would invariably show up with a box of oysters and a shucker. And I remember one year we had a friend of ours opening the oysters on my back porch. And this guy's actually now an instructor at CIA. And he was opening the oysters, and he had a little bit of mignonette, but it was a very hot day, and he kept sweating into the mignonette. And I said, you know, the sweat mignonette I'll leave on the side. I'll have mine plain, although I'm sure it's lovely with the oysters. But
added a certain brininess to the oyster that it didn't have prior to that.
Now, John, you're in the restaurant side as well as the production side. Where oysters on the half shell are in American culture has really changed. I mean, you have real oyster enthusiasts today on the East and the West Coast, but in the 70s, that wasn't the case. Most oysters were either fried or put in a can or
it's a relatively new development.
Or served with cocktail sauce. What? Give us the take on what's happened in American cuisine with raw oysters on the half shell, specific varieties of oysters.
Well, I think what's happening is, you know, oysters used to be a huge thing in this country back 100 years, you know, 150 to 100 years ago. I mean, it's a huge thing because they were widely available and they were inexpensive. And as soon as the railroads started reaching out across the land, you know, they carried the oysters, and they were everywhere in the country. You know, oysters were oyster restaurants, and oysters on the menu was the most common food almost.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went away for a number of reasons about, you know, right after the Prohibition. And then we entered into what I refer to as the American Oyster Dark Ages.
Uh-huh.
And that lasted until, you know, kind of the early 80s.
What was the cause of the Dark Ages? Why don't we talk a little bit
about
that?
Well, the reason oysters went out of our culture back then was, I think, a combination of, we had the Prohibition. Oyster houses were very convivial places, and they had, you know, beverages were part of the experience. And then when the Prohibition came, a lot of those big, grand oyster houses
they couldn't make it selling juice with their oysters.
No,
yeah,
I think perhaps that's why I like oysters so well.
Cider didn't work, and you know, like Chicago was a huge oyster city back before the Prohibition. Then after the Prohibition, a lot of those oyster houses shut down.
Do you know what they say? And I remember reading that the oyster, you know, the way that human beings work is, and they say, you know, the Native Americans who lived on Manhattan Island were huge. There were piles, there were mountains of oyster shells because they used to love to eat the oysters. But, you know, the quest for food all species look to gain calories and nutrition from food more than they have to expend in order to get that. The oyster is one of those few things that, for early man in particular, it took more energy to get an oyster than you got from the oyster, calorically speaking. And so it's really just about taste, you know? And I think that's really a fascinating thing about the character of the oyster.
Well, actually, I read in Mark Kalansky's book, he yep. said that there was not much nutritional value to the oyster, but I disagree vehemently with that. The oyster is actually a very nutritious food. About the only thing they don't have is fat, but mm-hmm. they have they're just full of minerals and a very good source of protein and lots of vitamins, and they're just a very almost a perfect food.
Well, I'll tell you. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, as long as we're talking about Kurlansky and his book, one of the things that I wanted to touch on was, you know, the fact that most oysters are very similar except for the waters from which they come, and you're a big proponent of kind of making sure those waterways stay as clean and as clear as they possibly can.
Very important. And that's one thing we have out here. We have a political climate, you know, out here that facilitates the kind of regulations it takes, you know, to keep the waters clean.
Well, without pristine waters, you won't have pristine oysters.
Well, but hold on a second. Not only do we have to protect our waters because if we're eating those oysters, that we have to protect the food that we eat, because oysters certainly are filters and they concentrate a lot of whatever bad things are in the water, but also oysters work to clean up areas of water, right? I mean, they're huge filters, right?
They do.
How does that work? How does seeding an area like in the Puget Sound? I know that the Olympias are a famous oyster that are from Puget Sound. How do oysters work to clean up a waterway?
Well, they go through. 50, 60 gallons of a decent sized oyster will go through 50, 60 gallons of water day, and so they're taking, you know, a lot of food out of the water. So what happens when you have a lot of fertilizers and things like that going into the water more than, you know, when you get more nutrients in the water than the local ecology is used to, then you can get overloaded and you got too much algae in there and it blocks the sunlight and, you know, things start dying on the bottom and that sort of thing. So if you have a lot of shellfish in the water, filter feeding, and it helps, it just helps keep the system healthy. And they're very, very beneficial. The more mollusks you can get in a bay, the better everything, better off everything is.
You know, it's funny. One of the things that I love about the oyster is that it's definitely a raw oyster on the half shell. is a totally a love it or hate it proposition. I mean, the people who love raw oysters like I do, I mean, there's a place called Blue Ribbon in Manhattan that to me still has the best oysters in New York. They're open till 4 a.m. I can be there. From leaving my restaurant to Blue Ribbon, I can be at the bar with a beer in my hand and oysters in front of me in 37 minutes.
Part of the reason they have the best oysters in New York, though, is because you can get one at 3:30 in the morning.
But that's my own personal formula is that the oysters do taste better later in the day. But the other thing is, when you look at whoever had the first oyster, because if you look at it, it's really not appealing, and whoever decided to eat one, I think that oysters and beer also go so well together, because to get your first oyster, you should have a couple of beers before you attack the thing, so it becomes a little more palatable.
Well, the beer is very, my oyster wine judges, that's after they do their wine judging, everybody wants a beer.
And
more oysters.
I completely agree, and I want to be invited to be a judge at the next competition. We're going to talk more in just a moment with John Rowley about oysters, and we're also going to talk to him. He is the dean of dirt, and we'll be talking about dirt in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking today with John Rowley. We've been talking about salmon and oysters, which two subjects on which he is quite knowledgeable and quite an expert. But recently your attention, John, has turned to composting, to dirt, to where things come from, to, well, manure. But what? Let's talk about... you've been called the dean of dirt. Why is dirt so important?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where you found that. But
on the web. Sorry, you can check it out. Google yourself.
See, because dirt is not. It's not such a good word. Dirt is what you find out in the playground.
How about the master of mulch?
Soil.
Soil.
Yeah, you mulch and you compost and you get humus, and when you got when you got humus, then you got good soil to grow flavorful tomatoes.
So how did you get involved in what do you advocate? I read somewhere that and you can tell me if this is true or disabuse me of my misinformation, that for your most recent wedding that Julia Child sent you as a wedding present a banana peel.
Yeah, well, we sent invitations to our wedding. It was a compost wedding, and we had a wedding in the community garden where I was the site coordinator, and my wife and I met on a compost and mulch forum, actually.
That's kind of kinky, I guess.
All right, then.
On the internet. So we invited our guests instead of presents to send us ingredients for this compost we were going to make as part of our wedding vows, renewal and all of that. And so we got about 2 cubic yards of very thoughtfully selected garbage that people sent us. Like Julia Child sent us a banana peel, and Sheila Lucan sent us her dryer lint, and so forth. And
well, it's very personal.
50, we got 50 pounds of 50 pounds of fresh buffalo manure from a friend in Colorado.
Very nice of them.
On and on and on.
Can you get in trouble for shipping that? I can't imagine that.
Well, the FedEx and the UPS guys, they were very amused. They wanted to know what we got every day.
Interesting.
I have to say, the one thing about that, you give somebody a gift like that, they can't return it.
when I was a kid,
they can't throw it away. It's already been thrown away.
My dad had a little farm in upstate New York, in Liberty, New York, and it was a nice spread of property, but we farmed about an acre of it. And one of the things that it was very important to that little garden, we'll call it, because it was less than an acre even, was the compost pile and composting. Absolutely. And, you know, it was the late 70s, early 80s, and I guess my dad was kind of a, you know, in front of the curve or behind the curve, depending on from where you look at it, you know, as far as the you know, early people farming, he was behind the curve, but as far as people today, he was ahead of the curve. And so, but we composted in that compost pile, and obviously we did all those things that you need to do to a compost pile as far as rotating it and aerating it. And then we used that in the garden. And I will tell you that some of the foods we got from that garden were the most satisfying, tastiest foods that you've ever gotten. Now, some of that, I'm sure, is because when you wait 3 years for a piece of asparagus, you have a greater appreciation for it. But at the same time, I mean, I can even tell you that the potatoes that came out of the ground, you know, white potatoes coming out of the ground, had more flavor to them.
Oh, absolutely. It's a miracle and magic, you know, what compost does in a garden, and it just, or organic matter, that things, you know, the secret of the whole business is just letting stuff rot and going back to the earth, and it's what drives the system, and what the reason why a lot of this agricultural, you know, this industrial agriculture, the food that's grown that way with fertilizers and pesticides and whatnot, is that depleted the organic matter, and a lot of that food just doesn't have flavor anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, and that's just the point. It's the same thing, and we see it most severely in winemaking, which is why you see almost all the winemakers have abandoned this sort of industrial agribusiness kind of way of doing business, because the food is not as flavorful. Eventually you wind up with, you know, hydroponic tomatoes are beautiful, but they don't taste like anything.
Right.
You know,
they taste like Hydra.
Yeah.
I use a refractometer to measure the bricks of tomatoes and carrots and
measuring the sugar levels in
everything,
in
because
essence.
How much you know, the Brix levels in the plants tells you how successful the plant.
And do you find that stuff that's grown with organic compost, normal compost, gives you a better quality of fruit?
Yeah, I did a very you know, good experiment in this. I have 130 gardeners in this garden where I was the community garden where I was the site coordinator there, and so we had a Brix log in the tool shed, and people would come in and they had a refractometer there, and they would measure the bricks of their whatever it was, and they'd entered in this log. We had a page for every.
So I guess you just take them out to the tool shed and whip them with the bricks log then, huh?
Anyway, John, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the Restaurant Guys with us. You've been great.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, John.
We'll be back in just a moment talking more about, I don't know exactly what, but it'll be fun. We're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. He's left the cafe party. We were talking with John Rowley before about, I think it was very interesting to talk about composting. It's not exactly the most appealing topic to talk about on a food show.
but it's an important part of the whole thing, and that's what we talk about here on the Restaurant Guys. We talk about the whole thing.
And you can talk about, and you can have at home, a compost pile in your backyard, if you have a backyard. That I have a number of friends who are gardeners who use a home compost pile. And look, it's not about just that, you know, that's a great way to keep some mass out of our landfills, but it's a way to make your tomatoes taste better, because that kind of rich soil really makes a difference on the plants that you grow.
You know, one of the things John was talking about at the very end of the last segment is he's talking about using a spectrometer, which measures the sugar levels in fruits and vegetables, and using that spectrometer in order to measure the difference between his composted fruits and vegetables and non-composted fruits and vegetables. And one of the things he found is that Brix level, that sugar content, went way up as he used composted materials to fertilize.
Well, and that just makes total sense. You know, there was a writer who wrote about the sort of fascination with you know, animal shows and animals from far places and strange animals, and he said something along the lines of, you know, if you want to see a bunch of strange stuff, get a microscope. Go to a hobby shop, get yourself an inexpensive microscope, and you can even hook them up to your computer now, and take if you have a compost pile and you have good healthy soil, take a teaspoonful of the rich soil from your own backyard, and you'll see a bunch of different stuff up there, some of which doesn't have names yet. And that sort of microflora and microfauna, that is much better than having a sterile environment from spraying a chemical on a field or on your tomato garden and killing everything that's
Well, that's
on.
And that's the idea of a lot of the pesticides and things that we use out there and fertilizers that we use out there. The idea is to kill everything in the soil and then use these manufactured products. We don't believe that's the best way to do it.
And when you talk about, people talk about fixing nitrogen, for example, in the soil, the reason that a sustained, you know, system of life, of living things in the soil keeps nitrogen in there all the time is it slowly keeps putting nitrogen in the soil. If you spray a nitrogen fertilizer on your soil, the next rain washes it away. And plants use those things a little bit at a time to make the great food that we love to eat. Hey, we have to leave it there. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.